Washington State, you are listening to The Mountain and the Word, an audio podcast show from the Mount St. Helens Creation Center, featuring news, views, and information with a biblical and scientific perspective. The Mountain and the Word is produced and presented by creation speaker Paul Taylor and is available for download from our website, mshcreationcenter.org.
Hello and welcome to episode 9 of The Mountain and the Word, which is our audio podcasted program from the Mount St. Helens Creation Center. My name's Paul Taylor, I'm the director of the center, and I'm delighted that you've joined us, that you're with us again listening to what we have to say. And as I stand here talking into this microphone, ahead of me I can see the open doors of the centre. Through that I can see the grass of the parking lot, and beyond that I can see a beautiful sight, Silver Lake in front of me. Silver Lake, it is thought, was formed from an earlier eruption of Mount St. Helens that blocked up a creek that must have existed in the area before the lake filled in. It's just interesting how much effect the volcano has had on this part of the world. And it's often interesting to think about what the results of that volcano are, particularly when we consider how beautiful the area is. People come to this area, they say it's beautiful, I can really see God's goodness at work. And while that is true, you must remember as well that we can actually see God's judgment at work, because volcanoes were caused as a result of the flood. They are the aftershocks of the flood. And we'll go into detail sometime, and I often go into detail in my talks about how the volcanoes of the Cascade Range, including Mount St. Helens, were formed as a result of the effects of the flood and the splitting up of the Earth's crust at that time. So, you know, the eruptions of these volcanoes are the aftershocks of the flood. And the flood was caused because of the sinfulness, the wickedness of men's hearts. God looked at the world that he had made and saw that the thoughts of men's hearts was always wicked. And that's why he sent a flood. So we've got to remember that. We talk a lot in these centers, in creationist centers, quite rightly, about the scientific mechanisms by which these things could have occurred. But we must remember that the actual reason for the flood, which of course came because of the sovereignty of God, because he decided it. And he decided it. He told us why he decided to send a flood. He decided to send a flood because of the wickedness of men's hearts. So really, the things that we see here, the beautiful lake that I can see right now in front of me, Silver Lake, is a beautiful sight. And yet it's the part of the aftershocks of the flood. God can make beautiful things out of things that were once broken. God can make beautiful people out of people who were once broken, people who were sinful and rebellion against him. But he, once they repent and they put their trust in Jesus Christ, then he can make them new people, beautiful people. And that's what we witness to in this center. That's the point of us being here. I've been thinking a lot about different aspects of education recently, and some friends of ours asked me to give some tutoring to their son in chemistry. He's very interested in chemistry, and so he's putting together some work on the subject. And we're looking at the subject of atoms, electronic shells, the movement of atoms in various reactions, in ionic reactions and in covalent reactions, well, ionic bonding and covalent bonding. So we're looking at all that, and we're looking at the reactivity of those things. And in particular, I was looking at the reactivity of metals. And it's interesting to note that evolutionary historians, don't really see a connection between history and science and the Bible. And we can actually see that link very clearly indeed. Every culture in the world, or almost every culture in the world, is reckoned by historians to go through processes such as Stone Age, Bronze Age, Iron Age, and then more technology after that. And of course, it's assumed that people groups that are going through those particular stages, the earlier stages we might talk about, it's assumed that they're more primitive. And it's perhaps not quite so politically correct, fortunately in this case, for people to refer to other people groups as being Stone Age. It's a sign of abuse, really, and it's saying there's something less intelligent about them. Well, I actually think there's a good, strong biblical reason for not ridiculing people and bringing people groups down by referring to them as Stone Age in that way. But in many ways, the people's use, evolutionist use of those terms, is incorrect. Now, let me just divert for a little bit and come back to what I was talking about with atoms, and particularly with the reactivity of metals. One of the things that's very important to understand is that there is a reactivity series of metals. Metals have different reactivities. For example, sodium. If you put a piece of sodium in water, it will react. It will catch fire. If it's held in place, it can explode. It's a highly reactive metal. We do not expect other metals to react so vigorously. Calcium, for example, will bubble in water. It will react a bit. It will produce hydrogen, but it tends not to be an explosive reaction. Now, aluminium can be made to react with steam, not with liquid water. It's a good job if you think about it, because most of our pans and things that we cook with these days are made out of aluminium. So we're glad that it doesn't react with liquid water. But if you heat it up, finely divided aluminium in steam, you can get it to catch fire. You can get it to burst into flames. Iron is slightly less reactive than that. You can just about get iron to react with steam. It will not catch fire, but you can get it to glow a little bit in the steam. Not quite so obvious. Of course, we know that it reacts slowly with water in the presence of air, and that can help oxidize the iron, forming rust. Less reactive than iron is copper. And tin is probably similar in reactivity to copper. They are much less reactive than iron. Copper can, in fact, be found as a native metal in rare places, but mostly it's found in ores. It's not that difficult to get out of its ore. Silver is very unreactive. You actually find silver as the native metal, as you do with gold, which is less reactive even than silver and doesn't tend to tarnish in the same way as silver. Now, if we go through the reactivity series in reverse, we'll see that there is an ease in technology. As I said, gold and silver are found as native metals. So although they're rare, it's difficult to find them. Once you've found them, the scientific process for getting them out is not that difficult. You can physically remove them, you can melt them a little bit and get them running away from the rock. It's a fairly straightforward process to get hold of the metals from the rock. Copper needs a bit of heat. You really need to heat the copper chemicals up, the rocks that contain copper, preferably with a reducing agent. It doesn't have to be a very complicated reducing agent. Something as unsophisticated as charcoal will do the trick. But you can get the copper reasonably easily from the ores without much technology. Same with tin. And the reason for me mentioning those two together is it's been known for a long time that you can make an alloy of copper and tin called bronze. Now, iron takes more technology because you've got to get a much hotter furnace. So you generate the heat by pumping air in. Now, in times gone past, iron was produced by furnaces where somebody would be operating bellows to blow air. You see, these days, machines would be used, oxygen lancers or that sort of thing, but you could get the iron in the past by heating very hot using a furnace where you're blowing air in to create huge amounts of heat. You will need a good reducing agent. Coke will help, but really you need such hot conditions that the coke, which is more or less pure carbon, is turned into carbon monoxide, and it's the gaseous reducing agent of carbon monoxide that really does the trick and helps you get the iron out. Now, aluminium is not that easy to get hold from its ore by chemical means, and these days is not usually produced by direct chemical reduction, but rather by electro chemical means, which takes a lot more power and therefore a lot more energy and a lot more technology. And sodium, similar to aluminium, but a great deal more energy required to be able to get the sodium out of its constituent compounds. So you'll see that the reactivity series gives you a reverse order of how easy it is to get the metals. But I was talking about history. Now, what's that got to do with history? Well, go back to the idea of there being a Stone Age, then a Bronze Age, then an Iron Age, and then a higher sophistication of civilization where we can get more sophisticated metals like aluminium. Do you see that that is similar to the reactivity series? Now, as I said, evolutionists will come up with what's really a politically incorrect scenario where they'll have to define certain people groups that have been through some of those stages more recently, or maybe even just going through them at the moment. They have to define them as less sophisticated and less intelligent. But that's not the way it is at all. For example, there have been people living in the British Isles for a very long time, and there are therefore stone tools around. And what's interesting is that these stone tools are very, very well made indeed. Not only that, but there seems to be clear evidence of there being a market in these tools. There were trading in these tools. For example, some stone tools have been found in Kent in the southeast of England, made from stone that's not found in Kent in the southeast of England. I beg your pardon, I said northeast before, I meant southeast. The stone is not found in the southeast of England, but rather in present-day Ireland. So they had to have been shipped across, the stones must have been shipped, and there's therefore evidence of a sophisticated business, a trade in these stone tools. So these were not unsophisticated people, but they were using unsophisticated media in order to produce their tools. Why? Well, when we look at things from the Bible, we can understand it, because these were the first tribes to have reached those islands from the Tower of Babel incident. The Bible tells us about how people were scattered, but after the Tower of Babel, they were supposed to have scattered themselves to fill the earth. They refused to do so. So God came down, put confusion in their language and forced them to scatter. And so these people who were making the stone tools were therefore the early people in that area. And when they eventually began to settle, they started using the materials that were around them, which would be stone. And then they gradually produced better metals by using easy technology to get to copper. And then more technology would produce iron. More technology still would produce aluminium. But this is a development. And in the early stages, with some of those early metal extractions, they probably knew about the technology, but it needed to be redeveloped because they had that technology before the flood. In fact, we read in Genesis 4 about Tubal-Cain, who was making things out of metal. He was working metal. And so this was clearly a sophisticated civilization before the flood. The flood destroyed all that. The Tower of Babel incident destroyed all that. People, therefore, were scattered. And that's why you get Stone Age, Bronze Age, and Iron Age at different periods, different timescales in different parts of the world, because they've taken different lengths of time to get to where they are now and to settle. And it was as they began to settle that they would then go through those stages. And there's almost an inevitability, but it's easy to understand when we look at the Bible, and we can understand that reactivity series, that they would have to develop those technologies in that order. It's difficult to follow that from a secular point of view, without leading to some sort of derogatory comments about the late development of certain people groups, whereas in a biblical context, we understand why there was a differential development. It wasn't to do with differences of intelligence, it was to do with differences in the time that it took for them to find where they were settling and to move on from that point. So this all fits into a biblical context, and it's really important, I think, that as we teach our young people, they start to see that there is a link between history and science, science and history, and all these things are linked in a biblical context. The Mount St. Helens Creation Centre can't stay open all year as a creation centre, as a tourist centre, that is to say. you know, because there's a period of time when tourism doesn't happen. And really, we're looking therefore at being open for tourists between May and October. But what about between October and May? I do believe we have an important mission to fulfill. I think it's important to get educational groups into this area, and I want us to expand the work that we do educationally. And by the way, if you want a centre to be open in the area in the summer when the other tourist centres are open and when visitors are coming up the valley, then we really need your support, and we would ask that you would prayerfully consider whether you can donate to us on a monthly basis to be able to help us to develop the ministry that we are doing. But when we have permanent premises, which we are looking for, actively trying to find at the moment, I want to be able to use that centre educationally out of season. We want to encourage people, particularly in independent Christian education and in homeschool settings. And thinking about homeschooling, it may be the case that when you've got high school age children, teenage children, they really need an education in science, and of course some parents are up to that job because some parents know a lot about science and can educate their children. Other parents are stronger maybe in languages and other areas and are worried about being able to give their children enough education in science. Well, we would love to help out there, and one of the things when we get permanent premises that I want to do is make an education centre, and that would actually include some science teaching. I would actually like to get a small size educational laboratory, a school laboratory that's kitted out for doing school type experimentation. It doesn't need to be big. It doesn't need to have 30 points workstations. Maybe half a dozen workstations would be sufficient, but it would just be enable us to bring in groups of children, homeschool consortia, to come in and to do some laboratory work. You know, I've realized that it's very likely that if I had a group of children with me for a day, I could probably get what amounts to nearly half a semester's work of science done with them, which would then free the non-scientifically minded parents to be able to train their children in the things that they have more expertise in. So that's something that we want to offer, and if that excites you, if you're interested in that, then again, as I said, please remember to give to us, to donate to us, and just get on board with ideas and how we can possibly develop the ministry. Well, there's a lot of other things that I want to do with an educational centre. I've talked a little bit about chemistry, and I do think there is a strong need for some chemistry courses. I've been very struck by another local ministry here in the Pacific Northwest called Northwest Treasures. I would urge you to go and have a look at the website of Northwest Treasures, and the couple who run that ministry have become very good friends of my wife and myself. They're called Patrick and Vicky Newry, and their website is northwestrockandfossil.com. It's a long name, so there's no spaces in any of that, but I'll just say it again, northwestrockandfossil.com. And what I notice they're doing is producing packs of theoretical and practical material, books and or notes, worksheets and rocks and minerals, educational materials for various different ages to train young people in geology. I just think that's wonderful. I don't know of anybody else who's doing things in quite the way that they're doing, but I'm so struck by that I'd like to do some similar stuff with my own expertise. My expertise is not geology. If you want help with geology, I will direct you to Patrick's website, which again is northwestrockandfossil.com. But if you want expertise in chemistry and in physics, then I can provide that. And what I'd like to do is to be able to produce similar units of work on the subject of chemistry and physics. And I have a particular way of teaching this because of the way that I was trained in teaching back in Britain, where I was involved in a science project there, a science education project, which started from real-life scientific things rather than from complex abstract thoughts, which so many chemistry courses particularly do. And I was very struck with that teaching project, and I think there is a way of bringing that into a Christian context, because I think it's a particularly Christian way of looking at things. That's why, for example, I was just talking before about the interface between chemistry and history. And it's this sort of thing that I think is very important. So I want to see those sort of courses. Again, if you're interested in what we're doing and want to support us, that's something that we want to do. But all these things involve time and involve finance and involve a lot of prayer. Also, another area of expertise that we have here is to do with web development. And I think there's a very important set of courses that can be done there. I've sort of drafted out an idea of a web development course, again for teenagers, for younger teens probably, starting in web development. And I think in a one-year course we can take them right through from knowing nothing about websites to producing fully responsive well-planned websites right at the far end. So the way I would work through those sort of things is this: would start with learning the HTML language, the hypertext markup language that's used as a structure for web pages, and then the language that's used for actually developing the style there, which is called cascading style sheets language. And then we'd start to look at server technologies then, how web pages can be produced on the fly in response to people's actions. So we get responsive web pages using PHP, which interestingly enough doesn't actually stand for anything at all, really. It's a very odd set of abbreviations. But that PHP is a language that can be used to structure server-side scripts that can put out tailor-made web pages, if you like, based on the reactions of the user on the other end. And quite often the data that's going to drive that needs to be held in a database. The most common web-based database is MySQL, or its offshoot, MariaSQL. And I want to train people in using that and linking that with PHP. And then show people how to use the various applications that have been built from PHP and MariaSQL lately, such as WordPress, and how to actually build your finished sites out of that. And oh, by the way, there are some other technologies along the way that you may have heard of. If you've heard of JavaScript and jQuery and Bootstrap, those are all things that will be included in that. So I'm trying to put together a one-year course for sort of younger high school kids that will take them through those practical things that are so important in today's society. Again, if you want to see those supported, I need the time and the finance to be able to do those, you know, because if I'm going to concentrate on those, I might need some other people here, and they would then need to be salaried to be able to look after the other things that we're doing. So all these things cost money. But those are things that we'd like to do. I'd like to see a lot of educational work done with this centre. There's a lot of things that we need to train our children to do in this creation centre. Now, we seek to be an educational resource for all ages. So that includes adults too, everybody, church groups, everybody. And maybe you'd like to interact with this show. I'd like to take some questions from you. Now, because the show is not live, I can't take telephone questions. I wish I could, and I would love to produce a live show at some point where people can call in and be able to interact with them. But in the meanwhile, how about your emails? If you've got questions on the subject of creation and Genesis and evolution, we can find answers. Send me an email. It might be in some cases that I'll need to get somebody else involved to help answer, but we can answer those questions. I'd like to have some emails in, so remember that, please. I did put together on the Mount St. Helens Creation Centre website at one time a sort of Quora-style section. It was a bit like the website Quora, if you're familiar with that, where people ask and answer questions. It's not a discussion forum, it's a question and answer session. Another well-known question and answer website of a similar type, again, where they don't have discussion on bunny trails. It's sort of technical stuff. Here's a question, let's have an answer. Another well-known one is called Stack Overflow. So I did have a part of the site which looked a little bit like Quora or Stack Overflow, and we can produce that again if you wish, but I did remove it because no one was using it, quite frankly. But I do want to get questions in. So if you've got a question on this subject you would like me to address in a future edition of this show, then send in your emails. The email address is info@mshcreationcentre.org. The MSH there stands for Mount St. Helens. If you can't hear me because of my lisp, I know I have a slight speech impediment. So it was an S, M, MSH, okay? MSHCreationCenter.org. info@MSHCreationCenter.org. Send us your questions and I will try and answer them on this show. Now, one very important question that people sometimes ask concerns the Ark. I'm just actually looking at our model of the Ark. The model of the Ark here is to scale, but it's a sort of box shape, and I'm actually more convinced of the answers in Genesis model. I think there must have been some boat shape to the Ark, but at least this is to scale. What I like about the scale is it's that we've got here is it's a well-known scale. It's HO scale, and if you know what that means, HO is the scale used for most model railways. So you can see the size of the Ark here compared to model railways. By the way, I'm going on a bunny trail now, but if you want to see what the Ark really was like, what the full size was like, go and look at the Ark Encounter. You can get some idea, I guess, by looking at their website, which is arkencounter.com. But you probably have to go and visit the place in northern Kentucky to get the full effect. Remember that Ark Encounter is a ministry of answers in Genesis, and it's just a wonderful thing to see. But I'm going off the subject here. I went down a bunny trail there. I was wanting to say what one question that people often ask about the Ark is, how could they fit all those millions of species of animal on the Ark? Well, there's a new book out, and I want to recommend this book. Okay, I'm not going to give you the full answer to that now. I want to direct you to this wonderful new book, and it's called How Many Animals Were on the Ark? And it's published by, jointly by, Master Books and the Ark Encounter. And inside that book, you'll find out about what the difference is between species and kinds. Because the Bible doesn't talk about species. That's a fairly modern scientific phenomenon. The Bible talks about kinds of animals. So you see that lions and tigers and leopards are in the same kind, a cat kind. They can interbreed with each other, so they have developed from a common cat kind since the flood. The two animals that would have been on the flood, on the ark rather, would not have been lions, would not have been leopards, would not have been tigers. They would have been the two cats from which the various members of the cat family have developed since. So then the question, I suppose, is how many kinds would there be? And that's a lot less. And of course, many of us in the creation world look back to a very important study done about 20 years ago by the creationist John Woodmerap, where he estimated a good conservative estimate of about 16,000 kinds on the Ark, which would have made approximately 32,000 animals. Now, judging the size of the Ark could easily have contained that many animals. But Answers in Genesis have been doing a lot of research lately. They have a peer-reviewed online free journal. Now, this is not the Answers magazine that Answers in Genesis produce. That's their popular style magazine, and it's a very important magazine. But on the web, you can actually find what's called the Answers Research Journal, which is a peer-reviewed journal. Now, trust me, it is more rigorous in its peer review than any secular peer-reviewed magazine. This is high-flying science. And a team of researchers, either with Answers in Genesis or associated with Answers in Genesis, have been researching this very question. You can read the learned articles on the ARG, Answers Research Journal, on finding out where exactly these boundaries are of kinds. And there's still more research to go. But the book, which is called How Many Animals Were on the Ark, is a popular summary of a lot of that research. And they have realized that actually the number of kinds is a good deal less than we even thought before. It's less than 16,000. It's probably something in the order of about a few less than 1,400 kinds. That includes all land animals today, and of course any extinct land animals, including dinosaurs, and of course flying animals, vertebrate animals, birds and bats, maybe flying dinosaurs, those sort of things as well. So actually less than 1,400 animals, of which the average size would be the size of a sheep, because there would be big animals and little animals. There was lots of room on the Ark. And this wonderful new book, How Many Animals Are on the Ark, will help you understand that bit. It gives you a lot of information on the subject. It tells you all about the word species and its development by the scientist Carl Linnaeus, who, by the way, believed Genesis to be true. It tells you about the variation within kinds. It uses as an example the bear family. You can read a lot of detail about what happens within bears so that you can understand how that particular kind works. It comes to its conclusion, explains the conclusion in detail, and then shows you a list of some of the more common types of family groups, the kind groups that would therefore have been on the ark. By the way, they're not the only people who've done a bit of work on that subject. I'd also recommend J.D. Mitchell's work. He's put together a very interesting book called A Guidebook to North American Dinosaurs, which looks at the various kinds of dinosaurs that probably exist in the fossil record of dinosaurs found in North America. An excellent book, and sort of groups those into kinds as well. And also tells you quite a bit about where those things can be found so that you can go and see the museums in those places, and if you're very fortunate, maybe even dig some of your own fossil dinosaurs up. So that's J.D. Mitchell's book, The Guide to North American Dinosaurs. But particularly I'm recommending to you the book How Many Animals Were on the Ark, published by Master Books and Ark Encounter at a price of $16. And we will have that in our bookstore very soon indeed. Well, that's all from this episode of The Mountain and the Word. Thank you very much for listening to us. If you want to find out any more information about any of the things that we're doing here at the Mount St. Helens Creation Centre, please look at our website, mshcreationcentre.org, where you'll find details about our location, our opening hours, lots of other information about what we're doing. We would love to see you, so come along and find out what we're doing here. Get on the phone, you find the phone number there, support us, and just talk to us, ask us questions about what we're doing, and we're here to serve you. We're here to serve God principally, and through him to serve you. So please get in touch with us, and we can talk, we can answer your questions, we can enjoy things together. Most importantly, we can point you towards the God who created this world, the God who judged this world in a flood which has caused its aftershocks such as the volcanoes that we have around here, and the God who will redo all these things, recreate all these things at a point in the future, because we have a blessed hope to come in the future. Thank you so much for listening to episode 9 of The Mountain on the Word. Please remember, keep your podcasting software up to date so that you don't miss the next episode of The Mountain and the Word.
The Mountain and the Word, an audio podcast show from the Mount St. Helens Creation Centre. For more information, visit our website, mshcreationcentre.org.